This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, as protests continue in Puerto Rico, learn about a controversial public-private partnership that's struggling to keep the lights on for more than 3 million Americans. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, the State Assembly passed a set of bills this week aimed at dealing with a lack of workforce housing in Wisconsin. The Republican authors of the bill say the legislation will make it easier to attract more young people to live and work in the state. Others have pushed back on some of the proposals, saying they'll limit local control and could lead to higher taxes for some homeowners. We're taking a closer look at the legislation, along with what's driving a shortage of workforce housing in the state and other ideas for dealing with that shortage. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is affordable housing an issue where you live? How much has housing factored into a job decision you've made? Do you want to see the state do more to address affordable housing? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Kurt Paulson is professor of urban planning at UW-Madison. Kurt, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, the pandemic didn't make this happen all by itself. You've been following housing shortages around the state for some years now, including a big report you did pre-pandemic. How big an issue was this?
So, as you pointed out, we've had a housing shortage in Wisconsin for the last decade. We've consistently added more people and more jobs than we've added housing units. So eventually that produces a squeeze in the housing market, the shortage of housing, particularly in our counties that are growing in terms of jobs, has meant that you have rising prices, limited selection, and as you pointed out in your intro, employers are having difficulty attracting and retaining a workforce when housing is not available or is too expensive.
Did the pandemic add to that problem in any way?
Yes, it added in a couple of ways. One, of course, it slowed down production of new housing, and the supply chain shortage has meant that lumber, fasteners, drywall, appliances, everything you need to make new homes is either more expensive or less available. And of course, as people spent more time at home, the demand for single family housing skyrocketed. With low interest rates, many families looked to buy or to buy a bigger place, and the inventory was just not available. And that's why we see price increases for single family homes, some cases over 15% in the state in the last year. And then, of course, on the rental market, most of our low and moderate income workers worked in industries like retail or entertainment and hospitality that really experienced significant income loss, job loss due to COVID, and real stress and strain in the rental market.
I've used the phrase workforce housing. Some of the lawmakers involved in the legislation have too. Is that a thing? Is that a slang term, or does that actually have a definition in your line of work?
Well, so like everything, every term both tells you something and doesn't tell you something. I think when the legislature is using the term, they're referring to the segment of the workforce that makes a little bit too much money to qualify for most of our existing affordable housing programs, but not enough money to afford a decent quality home near where they work. So for example, if you think about the Green Bay area or Sheboygan or Appleton, we're talking about there a family that might make between $46,000 to $80,000, right? Those incomes are a little too high to qualify for most federal programs and not quite enough to purchase a home or to be able to rent close to where they work or where their kids go to school. Of course, people who make less than that are in the workforce, and so that's where the term can be confusing. And of course, seniors and children need decent, affordable homes to live in, and they're obviously not in the workforce.
We're talking to Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning at UW-Madison, looking at a shortage of workforce housing in many parts of Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Can you afford to live near where you work? Or if you had to move further away than you wanted to, maybe take on a longer commute because you couldn't find something affordable in that same community? Have you lived in a neighborhood for a long time and been astounded to see how much housing costs have gone up When your neighbors sell their houses, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Kurt, let's get into what we're seeing in the state legislature now. The assembly passed a package of bills related to this. Real estate groups and housing developers like what they're doing so far. Do you see bright spots here? Do you see things that could put a dent in this problem?
Yes. So a number of the bills could fall into kind of two buckets, each of which taken together starts to really move the state to address this issue. Of course, the shortage of housing has been long in development, and so we're not going to see immediate solutions. So one of the buckets of policies in the pieces of legislation are what we would call financing tools. So there's a expansion of a state housing tax credit to assist in the development of housing for the workforce. There's a sales tax exemption for materials used in the production of workforce housing. There was a bill that allows local governments to create what are called local housing investment funds, where they can capture some of the increased tax revenue from new housing development and use that to fund additional workforce housing development and improvements in their community. And then the other financing package is a loan program for the rehabilitation of older housing. And one of the reasons that's important is we have a lot of older housing in the state. We haven't built as much new stuff. And so a lot of where people live is actually older housing. Then I would say the other tool or bucket that has some of the legislation in it is what we would call zoning reform, where Wisconsin is beginning to take the first steps to reforming some of our zoning policies, similar to what you're seeing in other states. So that particular bill would say to cities and villages, if you have water and sewer available, so you're an urban municipality and you can accommodate it, you need to have one of your zoning districts allow multifamily construction. And so that's really trying to get at one of the barriers to workforce housing, which is that we have many communities that zone most of their land only for single family housing and don't allow apartments to be built.
Now, zoning, I think people hear zoning and maybe eyes glaze over. Some people around the country are really excited about that thing you just talked about, that change to say you have to have some areas or maybe even an entire city that isn't just single family housing. You need to allow, it could be an apartment building, it could be a duplex, it could be you're able to rent out the upstairs space to, you know, a single person or something like that. How much of a difference could that kind of change make?
Well, so this piece of legislation, I think, is the first in a number of potential reforms, much like you discussed in other states. So, for example, in a lot of our communities where there is no apartments allowed to be constructed, this legislation could potentially lead to perhaps 1,000 or more apartments being built all around the state in our various cities. So that really begins to make a dent in the housing affordability challenge, because we know that when you build more housing, eventually that opens up the housing market in the middle and at the lower end. And the lack of this housing right now means that people who do have means, people who earn a higher income, are taking the available housing, and that squeezes out or prices out people on the lower end of the wage scale. Or as you pointed out, a lot of communities have a lot of jobs available, but they don't have a lot of housing near those jobs. So building more apartments and other types of housing, like, as you mentioned, duplexes, townhouses, those kind of granny flat apartments, mm-hmm. near where people work should shorten commutes and also deal with the housing affordability challenge.
We're talking to Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning at UW-Madison, with us today to talk about workforce housing in Wisconsin, a shortage of workforce housing in Wisconsin, and a set of bills aimed at dealing with that issue that recently passed in the state assembly. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has this been an issue for you lately or in the past? Have you been able to find housing close to where you work? Would you want to live closer to your work if you could afford it? How much time do you spend commuting? How does that impact your life? Are there changes you think might help? Do you want to see communities change from allowing only, say, single-family residential housing in a lot of areas to having more of a mix, including multi-family units? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our look at what's driving a shortage of workforce housing in Wisconsin, some possible solutions to the problem, and action in the state legislature on the issue. Kurt Paulson with UW-Madison stays with us, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a shortage of housing, or at least housing that most people can afford in your neck of the woods? What are you seeing there? Have you had trouble finding a place you could afford to live, especially if you wanted to live near something, say the place you work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Kurt, I see Wisconsin's housing agency has awarded money for state housing tax credits for 2021. Is that the sort of strategy you think can help things out?
Yes. So a few years ago, Wisconsin did create a state housing tax credit, really to supplement the federal housing tax credit program, which is the largest production side program for building affordable rental housing. And as I mentioned, that program has been very successful, building units around the state. And the legislation passed on Tuesday creates a newer version of that tax credit, specifically focused on those kind of middle income workers. For example, as I said before, people who make between about $46,000 to $80,000.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Heather is with us in Madison. Heather, hi.
Hi. He actually just kind of said my comment, which is that a big problem with building multi-unit rental, low-income rental in particular, as a former village representative zoning person, is that the property tax, when you look at how we raise income for the state government to function, we largely do that through property tax. And this isn't just for multi. So we fund our state government that way.
You're breaking up, Heather. I'm sorry about that. Do you have thoughts? What are some of the obstacles, Kurt, for a local government official in changing that zoning? Does it affect the kind of revenue they bring at the local or state level?
Right. So I think there's two things we have to say here, which is that renters actually do pay the property tax, but they pay it through their rent because the property tax is still assessed on the apartments. Mm-hmm. And so I think oftentimes people assume renters don't pay the property tax, but they do. They pay it through their rent. And that's obviously how we fund local public services like education, police, fire, and roads. But what you hear from a lot of municipal officials is that they feel they are being squeezed with the property tax limits and the difficulty to maintain services without raising property taxes. And unfortunately, I think they feel the pressure to resist new housing development, thinking that new housing development causes the problem, when in fact new housing development, because it adds to the tax base, expands your ability to keep funding the local public services that you do have.
Thanks a lot for the call, Heather, at 800-642-1234. Sorry, we lost you there. Joseph is with us in Madison. Joseph, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up, Joseph?
I live here in the Madison area, and I too it's a struggle to find affordable housing. I have to live at least a 10-minute drive away from where I work, and I really wish there'd be a little more supply. It's really hard to find anything these days.
Joseph, have you been looking for, I don't know, months or years now to try to get closer to your workplace?
Yeah, a couple months now. Ever since the pandemic, I'd say, settled down a little bit. It's just been really hard. Everyone seems to be moving, trying to actually look at purchasing properties. That, too, is it's just it's a nightmare.
Joseph, thanks a lot. You said a 10-minute drive?
It's more like 15-20, and I'd love it to be 5 or less. That'd be great.
Thanks a lot for that call. Kurt, I imagine there are some people in the same boat, but thinking, oh, I'd go for 10 or 15-minute drives. A lot of people face it, not to dismiss Joseph's problem, but a lot of people face even bigger commutes.
Right. And in particularly in here in Dane County or Waukesha County or the Milwaukee area, we see commute times of 30, 40, 50 minutes. You know, there's in most of our job centers, that's Dane County, Brown County, Waukesha, and Milwaukee County, there's far more jobs than there are housing units available. And so that does mean that people have to drive long distances. If you know, there's about 40,000 people who commute into Waukesha County every day to work. And some of them would prefer to live there if they could afford it. So I think the caller's point is exactly correct. When we think about the cost of housing, it's not just how much you pay in rent or mortgage. It's the time you have to spend on the road driving. And there are people who live an hour away because that's the only thing they can afford. So expanding workforce housing, especially in job centers, will allow more families to choose to be able to live closer to work and commute less. And that helps us all.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Talking about a shortage of workforce housing in Wisconsin, Kurt Paulson is with us with UW-Madison's Department of Urban Planning. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have an experience to share yourself. Kurt, you mentioned some of the main job centers in the state struggling with this issue. Does this shortage of affordable housing affect other communities, even if we're outside of those bigger urban or suburban areas?
Absolutely, and thanks for reminding me. You know, Representative Armstrong from Barron County reminds us that he has 1,000 jobs open in Barron County today. And Sheboygan County has 3,000 jobs open today. Marinette, La Crosse, all of these areas, even small towns, have jobs that are open, but they have difficulty recruiting workers because there's no housing available in those communities. And from the state's perspective, these are good jobs in production and manufacturing, and we would like to have people move to take these jobs, settle down, raise a family, build and invest in communities. But if there's no housing, it's really hard for employers to get the workforce that they need.
Is this something that the market would sort out eventually? If there's a lot of demand for housing in all the areas we're talking about, it'll come eventually? Or do you see a need for intervention, say, from the state government?
Well, I think the reason a lot of state governments have started intervening is they recognize that the market and some of the actions of local governments in zoning together have helped to constrain the supply. And the truth is that if you think about these 3,000 jobs that are open in Sheboygan County right now, the market is building housing, but oftentimes the housing that they can build is at a price point that is too high for the entry level of the workforce, for your teacher or your nurse or your entry level production worker. And we can start to bring down some of those costs by allowing a greater variety of housing, smaller housing on smaller lots through zoning reform. But what this legislation also looks at is that the costs of infrastructure help to drive housing costs high. And so some of these monies from local investment funds can be used to build the infrastructure that allows housing to be built, which helps to lower the cost, which helps to retain and recruit workforce to the area.
Bring on another caller now. Angela is with us in Fish Creek. Angela, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say I live up in Door County where we're a very tourism-driven community. And this summer, there were so many businesses that had help wanted signs, reduced hours, lots of closures, despite having a peak tourism year because there were staffing shortages. And there have been people who have tried to create affordable housing opportunities for seasonal workers, and they've been shut down by the local community governments. And we need the that kind of housing, but also year-round housing. We have an issue where any affordable house gets bought up with an all-cash offer and turned into an Airbnb or a second, third, fourth home for people who don't stay year-round, and it's really becoming a problem, and we need to find solutions to it.
Interesting. Angela, thanks for sharing that. Kurt, a lot of communities in Wisconsin depend on tourism. Is this a common story?
Absolutely. You think of any area that depends on tourism, and as Angela pointed out, second home development or Airbnb, you know, especially for a seasonal worker who's making maybe even $20 an hour, there's just no housing in Door County for those workers. So I think Angela said it best. And as a state, if we want to support our tourism industries, then that's where investment in affordable and workforce housing needs to work in terms of partnership with the businesses and the local communities. So when she talked about how people want to build this housing in Door County to house workers and local communities turned it down, that's one of the challenges we're seeing, is that local communities, I guess you could say it's short-sighted. They want jobs in their community, but they don't necessarily want the housing for the workers who fill those jobs. And ultimately, that's self-defeating, because if you ignore your workforce, as Angela pointed out, it's just hard to get workers to move to an area if there's no affordable housing.
Thanks for the call, Angela. And Kurt, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning at UW-Madison, with us to talk about workforce housing in the state and some new legislation in the state assembly. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's this week's edition of Food Friday, and it's pizza. The author of a 4-volume guide to pizza joins the show with everything you want to know. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll look at the link between domestic violence and a rise in amber alerts here in Wisconsin, plus signs of domestic abuse and where people can get help. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, being a caregiver for a loved one with dementia can be a difficult job, to say the least. We'll talk about different techniques for family members to cope with the challenges of caring for family members with dementia. First, we're going to talk about domestic abuse in this next conversation, so we want to give you some contact info right up front if you need help. For emergency crisis and intervention resources, you can contact the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-7233. That's 800-799-7233, or visit them online at thehotline.org. We'll give you that info again at the end of the conversation. Since the program's launch in 2003, Wisconsin has averaged 2 Amber Alerts per year. That's the statewide notification system for missing and endangered children. So far this year, there have been 11, and there are more than 9 weeks left in the year. Those 11 make up more than 20% of all Amber Alerts ever issued in the state. Authorities say they don't know what's causing the rise in cases. At least 4 of them involved domestic violence prior to the alert being issued. The State Department of Justice says other states are also reporting more Amber Alerts, but not necessarily connected to domestic abuse. So what's going on? Ashley Lutheran is a crime reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She covers public safety, crime, and policing. Ashley, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So usually 2 a year, 11 this year. What are some of the reasons, Ashley, that authorities think might be contributing to this rise in Amber Alerts?
Well, as you noted in the introduction, authorities here in Wisconsin are not seeing any definitive trend that is related directly to the increase. However, there have been several cases that are linked to violence against women. And that is something that came up obviously here in Milwaukee recently with the case of Mallory and her son, Major Harris. And it's something that domestic violence advocates and those who help survivors note that there is this intersection between child abduction and violence against women.
Now, Amber Alerts, let's take a look at when they are given. It's not just any case where a child goes missing. What are the criteria for issuing this Amber Alert that we might see pop up on our phones and TV screens and on our radios?
So the criteria is very specific. There are three criteria that must be met. The missing person must be a child 17 or younger. The child must be in danger of serious bodily harm or death. And the law enforcement agency issuing the alert must have enough information about the child, the suspect, or the vehicle to believe that an immediate broadcast of that information would help in locating the child.
How effective are Amber Alerts, as far as we know?
As far as we know, Amber Alerts are very effective. Most children, according to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, most children who are the subject of an Amber Alert are found within 12 hours of the alert.
We're talking to Ashley Lutheran, crime reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about a rise this year in Amber Alerts. She also reported on the link with domestic abuse and domestic violence. Ashley, you talked to people who advocate for victims of domestic violence and work to help prevent it. What kind of things did you hear from them about the connection between domestic abuse and abductions of a child?
And I'm sure your next guest expert will be able to address this too, but a lot of them spoke about the connection. We know that domestic abuse and domestic violence really centers on power and control. And unfortunately, children can become one of those pieces of power control that an abuser can use. And oftentimes, people who are in a situation of domestic violence, they may not even be most concerned about their own safety, but rather even more concerned about their child's safety. And so it becomes a really complicated and dangerous dynamic within the home.
And you heard about this connection between Amber Alerts. One of your sources with End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin said, I'm quoting from your piece here, "When my phone goes off with an Amber Alert, I think this is probably involving domestic abuse, but wondering, does the public make that connection?" That connection, though, as you go through case by case, often is there. The domestic abuse is something connected to what we end up seeing as that Amber Alert, right?
Yes, and you can even broaden it out, because more than 60% of Amber Alerts nationwide involve some sort of parental abduction. And so the expert I spoke with from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children pointed out that there has been an increasing trend of Amber Alerts being used in domestic cases. Perhaps there's not documented domestic violence within them, but there is growing movement to use these Amber Alerts, understanding that if a child's with a parent, that may not always mean that they're safe. There may be other custody issues at play, other factors going into it. And that's different from perhaps how law enforcement and others might have, even the public might have viewed that situation in years past.
And Ashley, as we wrap up, what are you watching for when it comes to Amber Alerts and their link with domestic abuse in Wisconsin?
I think it will be really important to see what other factors and what other information is released about the cases that have already been identified this year, and to see if at the end of the year, experts with the DOJ and also those who work to address domestic violence can pull any larger trends from what we've seen this year.
Ashley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Ashley Lutheran, crime reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where she covers public safety, crime, and policing. We talked with her about a rise in Amber Alerts in Wisconsin this year and their connection in many cases with domestic abuse. Coming up, we'll talk to an advocate for victims of domestic violence about the warning signs of abuse and where people can turn for help. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced domestic abuse in your own life? Is that a story you're willing to share? What would be your advice for someone dealing with that right now? Do you work on this issue, maybe with people who are domestic violence survivors themselves? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. According to the National Domestic Violence Hotline, nearly 20 people are physically abused by an intimate partner in the U.S. every minute. It comes out to more than 10 million people each year. Group also says that in Wisconsin, more than 36% of women and 32% of men will experience intimate partner physical violence or intimate partner rape or partner stalking in their lifetimes. And the last year, a little more than a year, has been particularly difficult. Our next guest says her organization has been serving more people than ever, and that's creating some challenges. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a domestic violence survivor? You can share your story if you're comfortable doing that. What helped you overcome it? What services do you need that maybe weren't there when you needed them? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Tracy Plowman is the Manager of Community Education and Prevention at Harbor House in Appleton. Tracy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
First of all, can you tell us about the kinds of services you offer at Harbor House?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a loaded question. We actually have a lot, just like all the other, most of the other domestic violence programs around the state. We have adult advocacy. We are a very large shelter program. We have legal advocacy. We have Black outreach advocate. We have a Hmong outreach advocate. We have Hispanic advocate. And so we kind of help people with, you know, trying to find sustainable income. We try to help them with affordable housing. We do, like I said, have the shelter program. We're open 24 hours a day. We're staffed 24 hours a day. We have a 24 crisis line. We help people, like I said, kind of navigate through the legal system. And then we have one-on-one where we work with individuals. We also have a really, really good children's program where we work with kids and adults. I'm sure we also have an outreach program in another county that we cover, and we have a full-time staff out there. We do community education. So I go into the community and I actually train people around the state about domestic violence and domestic violence programs and services. And then we also have somebody that actually goes into the schools from like first grade until 12th grade and does age appropriate education and awareness there.
And I saw local reporting, Tracy, that Harbor House and I imagine other similar organizations around the state, unfortunately saw an increase in demand for a lot of those services, especially as we open back up from the pandemic. What kind of things have you seen there?
Yeah, it was, you know, it was stalled a lot. I mean, we did a lot of video stuff and phone calls and stuff like that, but it was really stalled. You know, and we knew it was trouble, because one of the biggest things with domestic violence is isolation. And so you get isolated from your family and your friends and any kind of outlets that you possibly have. And COVID just compounded that. And so nobody, you know, people who were living with domestic violence had no, you know, everybody was home, working from home. And the kids were home. And so there wasn't the chance to call or to get out of the house and go see an advocate or something like that. And so once everything kind of started opening up, probably early June to mid-June, we went from a jump from about mid-20, like 24 people in less than like a week to like 68 or 69 people. And that was in 1 week. And it was right after things started opening up.
And I understand for the shelter part of your services, you rely on donations for a lot of the goods, a lot of the basic necessities you provide. And that stalled too during the pandemic, right?
It did. Yeah. The donation, and that's one of the things that hasn't picked up yet since things have opened up. So we have between 70 and 80 people. We're a 68 bed domestic violence shelter, which is, I think, the largest standalone domestic violence shelter in the state. And we're over capacity, well over capacity. And all of our donations that we have or had are now going very, very fast. And people are just, you know, and I don't know the reason behind it, but people are not donating the way they were prior.
Talking to Tracy Plowman with Harbor House in Appleton, community education and prevention manager there, talking about domestic abuse during Domestic Abuse Awareness Month around the country. You can join in with your questions, maybe your experience, at 800-642-1234. Tracy, what are the warning signs for someone to start to realize that they're in an abusive relationship?
I think that one of the most important things is understanding that it's not just about physical violence. and the community and people living in it tend to think that it's not that bad because, you know, they haven't been hit or it hasn't become violent, physically violent. And there's a whole lot of things like isolation and manipulation and financial abuse and verbal and emotional abuse and using the kids, you know, against you. And you know, there's all different threats and stuff like that. So there's a whole lot of things that happen other than the physical violence. And we just don't recognize it. You know, when you're in a relationship, when every time that there's an altercation, there's yelling, screaming, swearing, calling you names, demeaning you, degrading you, when it turns into those personal attacks, that's a warning sign. And also when you want to do something or you feel strongly about something and you get threats, that's a warning sign. And so, you know, when you're with somebody and they constantly are causing issues between you and your friends or you and your family, causing you to choose them over those people, that's how we end up in isolation. And so that's a red flag.
You mentioned outreach into schools. What kind of work do you do, and maybe what kind of work is needed to make sure that A, people can recognize the signs that they're being abused in a relationship, but also to build a healthy relationship where neither partner is abusive in the first place?
Yeah, we have a full-time staff person that goes into the schools and all the schools, at least, you know, in the Fox Valley, and does age-appropriate awareness. You know, and when they're really young, we start out with bullying and self-esteem and how to be a good ally and how to stay safe at home. You know, one of the main things with kids is we don't want them to get in the middle because they get hurt if they get in the middle. And so we want to make sure that we try to help them with that. And then as we get into, you know, middle school, then we want to start actually talking about dating violence and understanding that it's not about physical violence. It's about somebody who's constantly taking or checking your phone. It's about somebody who has a problem with all your friends. It's about somebody who wants to monopolize all your time and complain, you know, gets upset with you if you don't wear the certain things or act a certain way. And then we go, as we get into high school, and we do talk about healthy relationships. What is a healthy relationship? And kind of the opposite of what the things that I just talked about.
How does the abuse affect victims in the long run if they aren't able to get the help they need?
You know, unfortunately, with domestic violence, it's a generational issue. And so when we're brought up in it, if there's no intervention, we kind of just repeat that behavior. I mean, we kind of all do that. You know, we can say we're not going to be like we're like our parents, but we are a product of the way we're brought up, whether that's culture, faith, or whatever. And when there is this kind of really unhealthy relationships and behaviors in the home, that's how we learn to kind of get what we want and show our value, unfortunately. So it follows us, unfortunately, into adulthood. And then we repeat and have those unhealthy behaviors. And then we have children and we just keep the generational cycle going. That is what we do without intervention. But if we get intervention, then we can start to make an impact on stopping the next generation of kids or the next generation of teenagers from having these abusive relationships.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I know this is a very sensitive topic, and I don't want to get personal, you know, with my own life, but I do believe that the churches bear a responsibility to guide people in a more holy life so they don't choose to be violent and they don't drink so much or do drugs or whatever is leading them on this path. I think religious institutions must step up and guide people toward a better path. I think that's part of it.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Do you partner, Tracy, with local faith groups for your outreach?
We do as much as we possibly can. The faith community is one of the communities that we really try to connect with, because especially if you kind of like what the caller said, especially if you are in a kind of community where it's a, I mean, it's a big thing. There's, you have a lot of people that, you know, go to their faith community and they're, and it's a big part of how they seek whatever, you know, their peace. And it's also their first place they go when they're struggling. And so you're right. And we try really hard to talk to people in the faith community so that we can educate them about what it is, what it really is, and how to really help the family. It's not just about the person that is on the receiving end of this. This is about the whole family, because it affects the whole family, and not just their, like their children, but their parents and their siblings. And it affects everybody. And so I agree 100% that the more faith communities we can get involved in helping the family as a whole, the better it would be.
Thanks for that call. I wonder, Tracy, if you have advice for someone who knows someone that's going through abuse. What are the best ways you think to support them?
I think the most important thing is to stay consistent and steady in your support. Unfortunately, with domestic violence, because a lot of people don't understand it, and they tend to judge, they tend to judge victims' decisions. And one of them is staying in the relationship. And what people don't understand is that most victims, most family members don't want the relationship to end. They want the abuse to end. And so, and it's important that we support that. The most dangerous time for a victim of domestic violence is when they leave. Now, does that mean I don't want them to? No, of course I do. But the person that knows their partner best and knows what the threats are against their children or whatever the case is best needs to be able to make those decisions when they feel it's right. And the rest of us need to support them. So what I would say is, when you notice something, say something, but say it in a compassionate, supportive way. Like, you know, I care about you. I'm concerned. This is what I've noticed. And is there anything I can do to help? And when they say, no, everything is fine, you take the fine and you say, okay, if you need anything, you let me know. And then you walk away. And then the next time you notice, you say it again. But you don't look at somebody and say, you know what, if you don't leave them, I'm done. I'm out of your life. Because the only person that wins is their abusive partner, because they've isolated them more.
Let's bring on another caller now. Mary is with us in Appleton. Mary, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Mary?
I have volunteered at Harbor House. I just wanted to say they do a fantastic job. And I was a victim of domestic abuse. My abuser is a minister. And I just want people to know that it can happen in all different professions and social stratas.
Mary, thanks for the call and for sharing your story. And yeah, this can happen to people in any walk of life, Tracy.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, we do find it in our faith communities. I've literally had clients who had to go to two or three churches so that they could continue to have their support in faith, because their abusive partner was allowed to continue to go to the different faith communities and manipulate all the people there. And so I completely understand that. It's the same thing we face when we're talking about a police officer, which we know also is a possibility. And it's very difficult because there's a lot of power. And again, remembering that domestic violence is about power and control. It's not about physical abuse necessarily. It's physical abuse is one tactic that's used, but it's about having power and control over everyone and everything in your life, and absolutely mainly your partner.
Mary, thanks for that call. And Tracy, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you.
That's Tracy Plowman, Manager of Community Education and Prevention at Harbor House in Appleton. We talked to her about domestic violence and where people can turn for help. If you are experiencing domestic abuse and need help, you can contact the National Domestic Violence Hotline. The number is 800-799-7233. That's 800-799-7233, or visit online at thehotline.org. Coming up after the news, we'll find out how family members can cope with the challenges of caring for a loved one with dementia. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.